My name is John Page, and I was born in Johnson, Vermont, right on the town line between Hyde Park and Johnson. So I was from both Hyde Park and Johnson. We went to school in Johnson. The village we did our business in was North Hyde Park, about a mile and a half away. On the Gihon River, they call it Gihon today, but it's Gihon, I can assure you of that. never went to high school. I went to Randolph when I worked on some farms after I got out of the eighth grade. And then I went to Randolph for 2 years. Spent 2 years at the Vermont School of Agriculture. And I worked a year and a half on J.C. Penney's farm down in Hopewell Junction, New York, down near Poughkeepsie. And I met Mr. Penney at that time.
He said to me, you know, people who swear just don't know how to express themselves. I can remember that. And he was a great friend of 4-H. He built the 4-H Center in Washington afterward. And when the herd was dispersed there at Hopewell Junction, he gave it to the University of Missouri. He was born out in Missouri, about 5 miles from where my mother was born out there at about the same time. I didn't know that until years later, but anyway, he was a very quiet man. He was in his late 50s, early 60s when I met him. And so that's the end of that story. But he'd walk around the barns. If you heard anybody swear or say anything they shouldn't, he'd go over and talk to them about it. He was very much of a, he liked people. He didn't like anybody smoking around the barns or anything. And but he'd love to get away from Mr. Hepburn and go around top of the hill and see what was going on, because Hepburn was showing him the best of everything, and he wanted to see it all. And he was a nice man. And he'd come up about once a month from New York, from his office down there, to see his farm, go back down, and had the Guernseys there. Well, anyway, I went from there into the Army. All of my age group was going in the Army at that time. So I went into the Army, and I was there 2.5-3 years. Came back and went to the University of Vermont. I spent 4 years out there, and then I went out to Ohio State for a year. And I came back to Bennington County to work for 1 year for the Soil Conservation Service. Well, I didn't like working for the government because they were operated out of Maryland, and they thought Vermont was Maryland, and they weren't up here enough to find out any different. And so they'd have these impossible things that you were supposed to do up here that you couldn't do here. And so anyway, this job came up when Harry Mittege left here. I applied for it. I had 4 or 5 people, a couple of which I knew and met at UVM. And I got the job. And I did better than Betty. I got $2,800 a year. This was later. Got $2,800 a year, which wasn't too bad in those days. And this is June 1952. And I stayed here 34 years as agricultural agent. And I replaced one of the nicest men you ever saw, Harry Mittege. And if anybody ever asks you, is it easier to replace somebody that's good or somebody that's bad, I'll tell you, to replace somebody that was good is a lot better. He was really a remarkable person. He became head of the Howard Bank and vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank and so on. Harry was a wonderful guy, and he set me down and talked with me about 5 or 6 different people and 5 or 6 things to be careful about. And that was all he ever did to tell me about the job. And he went from here over to New Hampshire. And I stayed here, and he went on to Boston. At that time, we had the Green Pastures Program, which was trying to get the farmers to do a better job of feeding their cows. You know, in those times, the poultrymen would stuff the grain into the chickens and see how many eggs they could get. The dairymen would see how little grain they could feed. And sometimes you'd think they were seeing how little milk they could get. This was the way things were at that time. 10 pounds of grain to a cow was a lot of grain then. And we had a lot of little farms in Mennington County at that time. I'd say 150. So they're all over the place. You can see where they were. How many in Stanford? 5 or 6 down Stanford. Ira and the Lawrences and the Fosters and who else? I don't know. But anyway, there was even in what we call the mountain towns or the towns like Stanford and Reedsboro, there was quite a lot of farmers in those days. And but most of them had 8 or 10, 15, 20 cows. And they were fairly backward in their thinking. Now, one Harry Mittigue was here. He put some of them on account keeping. They didn't keep accounts, didn't file income tax. These farmers never knew what they were. So Harry got some of them going, and I'd seen some of the books he set up, and I kept going on it. And depreciation sheets were kept on the income tax form. And that was the only time they didn't know what depreciation was, and you had to explain it to them over and over. Some of them never did learn because they didn't want to. Because when they bought a tractor, they wanted to charge it off. You know, it's an expense, and you can't do that. Well, anyway, we got a lot of them in. We got a lot of these people changed over. Got them to keep in records and so on. And as far as I know, Uncle Sam never got on any of them to speak of. They started doing things like they should. But the things were pretty loose in that area at the time.
Now, excuse me, John. You said when you started that Harry Mittigue told you about 5 or 6 people that you should know about.
Well, yeah.
And 5 or 6 things that you should know.
Yeah.
What were those 5 or 6?
Well,
he
says when you go talk to the garden club, don't use the word manure. This is funny because later it's all they wanted to talk about was manure. But he says you call it barnyard compost and things like that. I don't remember what it was. He told me one of the things that Dean Kerrigan told him. He says, you won't have any trouble with new things, to teach farmers new things. They're eager to do that. He says your problem is going to be to change their mind on something that's really wrong and is really hurting them, but it's a habit they have and they can't change it. In other words, you've got to unlearn them before you can teach them something new. That's what's difficult. And though I found that out on farm after farm after farm. They all kept bulls in those days. And, you know, it was a real hard thing to get them to start using good bulls. Artificial breeding was there. It was working. And they didn't want to. A lot of them just wanted to keep their bulls. Had one lady in Pownell. She called me up. Her husband was about 80, and she was about 50. And they had a son. She had a son. He just died a while back. And she said, John, she said, her husband's name was John. He says, you know, John's out there running around with that 2-year-old bull out there, and he's 80 years old. He just can't get out of the way. That bull's going to kill him. Would you come down here and tell him about artificial breeding? So I said, yeah, I'll be down. So I went down, I talked with him, and he was willing to talk. He sat and listened. And then he listed all the reasons why artificial breeding wouldn't work. Which none of them were very valid. But the best one of all was, it ain't fair to the cow. And I can still remember that. And finally, the bull did hurt him a little bit. And from then on, he was a great help in that area for artificial breed. He was telling all the other farmers and his relatives who were farming around him, oh, this is wonderful. Have a marshal come down and breed those cows. You might have to fool around with that bull. And you're getting some good animals out of it. And he was a great help once he made that change. But it took a bull to do it and knock him around a little. And incidentally, his wife was from Stanford, Lincoln, Maud Lincoln. You remember Maud? Yeah. Wonderful person, Maud was. She was a nurse up at the hospital. And anyway... you said tell you what some of the he told me a couple of guys. One of the fellows, sometimes people. He had one fellow who owned some farm upon the hill here in Bennington, and he wanted to pull some deal in with lumber, and he wanted Harry to help him. And Harry said, "No, I'm not going to get involved in this." You know, this guy was trying to. skin somebody for get money. Harry said, no, I want to help you. And this guy really turned on Harry. And he told me a few people like that to be careful of. They were just, and he was so right in most cases. Sometimes I got along fine with him afterward, but but I remember the main thing he told me was, it's not hard to teach new things. It's awful hard to unteach them. Old things first, man. This is the, well, I'm knocking that thing around. Okay, I'm a wiggler. Yeah. Well, those are some of the things that happened in the early days. And Marion Hardy, she was still living. She wasn't a 4-H agent any longer. She lived up in Shaftesbury. She ran an orchard up there, and she was had a little patch of strawberries, and she could get more strawberries off an area no bigger than this room than you can imagine. She knew exactly how to do it. She was a great plants lady, as well as being a wonderful person. She had a temperament that was just impossible. Betty would know this. I don't know how she ever got along with any of the leaders, but they all knew her, and they all knew she was really good. And so they tolerated this. But you never knew when she was going to blow at you, and which is quite often.
If I can interject here, I'm talking about Miss Hardy. She was a wonderful gardener, and when we had 4-H Camp Bondua, she would have Bernie Whitman stop by her garden and bring up fresh produce for the camp kitchen. And he was told to bring some onions, and he pulled up all her onion sets.
She told him to bring red onions, and he went and pulled the brown ones.
Just threw those onions into the air every which way, didn't say anything, just was flinging them. And I was doing a craft program in the dining room, and the kids are all looking out, and I said, "Look, come on over here and let's look at this," you know, trying to distract them.
She had an awful temper, but she had a heart of gold too. And all of the 4-H kids respected Marion, even though they knew she was a little different than other people. Yeah, and let's see, we were still back in the early 50s.
At that time, excuse me, John, there was the big transition from milk cans to bulk tanks.
Well, that was a little after.
Okay.
The first thing to come, they had the Green Patches program. The farmers used to turn their cattle out in the spring, and they'd graze the pasture down until it looked like a golf green. And then the cows didn't have anything to eat, and the farmers didn't have anything in the barn to give them, except they'd give them 8 or 10 pounds of grain a day, and then the cows' milk production would go down, and the farmers couldn't do anything until fall came and the grass came back. And this was the way they operated. And instead of having feed for them, well, the Green Patches program got better pastures by using Ladino clover and some of those other clovers, rotating the pastures to some degree, and also a lot of them raised extra corn. And when the pasture got short, they'd feed them hay or feed them corn silage. Pretty soon the farmers found out that by stuffing the cows all the time, the milk production would stay up there, and they could make more money, and then they found that out. But it took them pretty near 10 years, over a long while, to do this, because it was a complete change in the way they'd operated. And pretty soon, a lot of farmers didn't turn the cattle on the pasture at all. And this is why we saw pastures grow up, even on farms, because there was nothing for the cow to eat, really, out there. They used to say, if you put a cow on roller skates and she went 40 miles an hour, she might get enough to live. You know, it was just not a good situation. Well, that was one of the first things we did. And the bulk tank thing came along in the middle 50s. Farmers used to handle these milk cans, and we used to have what we call 2-can farmers and 4-can farmers and 6-can farmers. And there was very few people had more than 50 cows, very few. And they had these, all of them by the time I came, they weren't using ice. They had graduated to So they have an ice to put in the tank. They were, had electric motors and compressors. And they lift those in and out. And that was hard work, putting those kegs in the tank. It was usually below at floor level, and pulling them out and loading them on the truck. And so the bulk tank came along, and some of the farmers welcomed it. Others said, no, I'll never do it. Because at that time, bulk tanks cost anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 for those that size farm, which was a lot of money. That's more farmer, more than most of them made in a year. So we had quite a bunch of farmers go out of business because they didn't want to make that change. Those who did make the change, there wasn't any way you could ever get them to go back to cans. They were, it was just a complete change over. And but that was just one of the things that happened. One of the other things that happened is the farmers were using, it's hard to believe now, but their milking machines, the milking machine companies like De La Valle and Conde and Universal and those people, they put little pumps, little vacuum pumps in the half horse motors in there, and they just barely keep the tit cups on the cow. And eventually, if you waited long enough, they would get the milk out of the cow. Well, Dick Dodge, the extension dairyman, he said, we're going to have to change that. And when Dick got after something, he was like a bulldog. He wouldn't let loose of it until he got somewhere. And he went after the dealers and everybody, and they got all the farmers. And finally, they started putting bigger pumps in, and the cows would milk out better, and the farmers all found this out. It took them quite a while. And they could milk the cows out faster. They had less mastitis, and this all was a part of these changes that went on about the same time the bulk tanks were going in, and they were feeding the cattle better. And later on, they just started dumping grain to the cows. They didn't. We used to say, well, this cow gives so much milk, so she can get so much grain. Well, that was when you had to think a little bit in order to feed a cow. But pretty soon it got to the point where a lot of farmers today just dump the grain into the cow. They mix it in there and just hope she gives milk. And, of course, DHIA records helped tell farmers what the cows were doing. So this is all a part of the changes that occurred over a period of 20, 30 years. And most of them got a 3-4 horse motor on their machine pump. They had trouble with the old lines. They had these little half inch lines running all over the barn. The milk would go by the trap and coat the inside that line, and it would dry on there, and then it would plug the lines. So we had a big project of putting in 1¼ vacuum lines on these barns. And a lot of times I've been out on farms in the middle of the night unplugging vacuum lines that we plugged up. We'd rattle them and try to get them loose so they could melt. And we'd rattle them and take them apart, and then you'd break them when you took them apart. So we were part-time plumbers sometimes. The farmer would get his tools out, and we'd have to fix the thing before they could finish milking in the middle of the night. Dick Dodge was in on all this. He was a great extension dairyman. And Dick was, when he'd start something, he'd go after it. And along about the middle of the 50s, some of the milk, when you taste of it, you could tell when the cow was on pasture. You could tell whether they were feeding them grass silage or not by tasting the milk. And this sort of thing, the off-flavored milk. And they had this milk flavor program. And the farmers didn't quite know what to do with that. Some of the county agents resisted it, including me, maybe. And we wondered, what's going to happen here? And so anyway, over a period of 3-4 years, that whole thing changed with the help of the Vermont Department of Agriculture and Dick Dodge and all the milk inspectors. And it was done in a very easy way with the farmers. Say, look, you can't sell a product if you don't taste good. And put it in containers where it doesn't oxidize, just colored glass and so on. Milk, if you leave it out in the sun, it'll get a cardboard taste, this type of thing. And those things weren't known at the beginning of that. They were just not a part of the dairy industry.
And they became a part of it. And so the quality of the milk we get today, in the old days, if you put a quart of milk in the refrigerator, it was you'd be very, very fortunate if you could drink it a week later. Now you can leave milk in there 2 weeks, as long as you don't open it, it'll stay in there. So things have changed a lot in the quality of the milk and how it's kept. And the UVM had a lot to do with this, the dairy department. We had a great dairy department up there. Dr. Riddell and those people helped with Dick Dodge and Stu Gibson, and all that bunch were in on that. And it was a decided change in the way the farmers operated. Yeah. Let's see now.
Now, Betty mentioned a radio program.
Oh.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I didn't know anything about radio programs. I don't think many of us did, but they had a station, WHDH or something, was it North Adams? I don't remember what it was. Well, that was the nearest one. We didn't have one here in Bennington at the time. So I decided, this radio business gets into the southern end of the county. So I went down there, and they let me come down there once a week and put on a little program. And I got the people in Reedsboro and Stamford. They probably weren't up yet, but when they come on. But anyway, then this station started. It swung it over, and they said, yeah. I said, we got a spot for you, 6:45 in the morning on Mondays and Tuesdays. It's yours. So for 34 years, I had that, 32 years, I guess, I had that program, Monday and Tuesday. And when I'd go away on vacation, I'd make tapes ahead of time and go on. And they still put me on the station three, four times a day now, because I went over about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, when they were fooling around with the station there. And I always stated in the broadcast, don't forget to drink your milk today. And so they still play it over here. So I am known as don't forget to drink your milk today by a lot of people. And I can find out how old people are, because it's been 23 years since I had a program. I can find out how old they were. They're at least 30 now. They wouldn't remember me. So I said, be careful, you're telling me how old you are. You know, the kids would listen to me, and their mother would say, John Page says, you got to drink your milk, you know. And so that's still going on. This is the leftover from way back in the good old days.
So it was mostly live when you did this? I
taped nearly all of them. Nearly all of them were taped.
Yeah.
A few of them were alive. Usually the ones that were alive is when I didn't get tapes made. And the tapes were usually made on weekends. I mean, all week long I'd be doing something else, and I'd come up Saturday morning and didn't have the tapes made for Monday. So I'd have to go down and do them on Saturday or Sunday. And sometimes I couldn't get to do that, so I'd have to go over to the station to make them, but not often. And it's a lot easier to do it with a tape, because if you blow it, you can start over. And you blow a few, as you know.
And it was about everything, or were you focused on
farmers, gardens, it was all about agriculture and country life. And what?
Tell in the closing line.
I did. I just did it. I just, don't forget to drink your milk today. Yeah, I just did it. And I'd get the forester on. We'd talk forestry. We had excellent foresters. And we'd get the specialists on from the UVM when they'd come down. They knew they were going to make a tape when they come down. And it's amazing how different they were. Len Rusha would come down and talk poultry. They make a tape with him, or two tapes sometimes. And the best guy of all was Ray Foles, the forester. The reason Ray was so good, you'd ask Ray one question, and then he'd sit there for the next 12 minutes, and Ray'd never stop talking. And then you had the other kind who would say yes, no. We had Harry Weldon, who became extension poultryman in Maine, a wonderful fellow. It was terrible to get on the radio with him, because he'd answer your questions, yes or no, every chance he got, and he wouldn't elaborate on anything. So some of the specialists were really good. Jim Wadsworth was very good. And Dwight Eddy, the extension economist, farm management man. And I made a lot of tapes with Dwight over the years on farm management and
why you keep records and what you do with them and that sort of thing. And the people who had nothing to do with farming learned a lot about farming, what went on in farming in the process. But I'd say only about half the tapes were directed at the people who farmed or gardened even. The nice thing about radio, and the other thing you can do with radio, you can repeat yourself 6 months later. Nobody knows you're doing it. We had a great guy that talked about beekeepers, and Randy Nolette from East Dorset. We made a series of 12 tapes on bees, 12 of them. That's the difference. And we decided what we were going to do with the 12 phase things in beekeeping. I had an awful time keeping him on the subject because he'd want to jump from one subject to another, and I'd say, no, we're going to stay with queen bees today. We're going to talk about queen bees. And he got the... So one day we made 12 tapes, and those tapes are still around. They're still using them around here. Because he knew his bees. I didn't know anything about bees, so I had to get people to help me do it, see. I don't know how to handle bees, but I went and got people who did know, and they're still using them. So this is a part of the work we did. And we had so many different projects. A lot of them were started by the specialists, so like the Green Patches program really never came to an end. Wenway sort of kept it going under different names and different methods of teaching and stuff, but we still have the remnants of that program left over after all those years. Yeah.
So 32 years, you said, with extension.
I was 34.
34.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was only on the radio for the first 2 years. I didn't have a station here.
Okay.
And then I used to write a news article every week. I started that along about 1960. The reason I started that is when Rachel Carson put her book out. Everybody was reading Rachel Carson, and they weren't gonna. I mean, you know what the book? Well, it was a book on don't use any pesticides and don't do this, don't do that, you know. And so I decided I ought to start writing articles. So I started writing articles, and I got so I could. I got in the paper every week. I put a. Had an article in the paper for over 30 years, yeah. And I got copies of most of them in here. Some of them, they're kind of funny to read now. You know, things change. Some of them I wouldn't dare to put on now. You know, they're talking about things that are different now. Yeah, but the nice thing about the radio and writing, the radio you can, do it over and over. Writing, you got to be more careful. You have to have new. And Bob Davis told me once, he said, John, he said, I don't think you should have two a week. It's 104 a year, and that's a lot of radio. But I never had much trouble with it. Because I got such a mouth, I guess.
So you must have seen quite a lot in those 34 years. Any particular stories jump out when you think back in your years of service with Extension?
Yeah, see, I also worked with, and Betty knows all about this, when you have organizations, when you work with for Extension, you work with the organizations that are around you. For example, I always worked very closely with the board, the artificial breeding directors who directed the local people. And I'd attend their meetings, and I wouldn't try to run them and tell them what to do or nothing. That was done out of Ithaca. But we'd always attend those meetings, so I always knew what was going on there. And so I could talk with farmers about the bulls and stuff. And this was one of the things you have to learn. The DHIA Association, that's run supposedly by a local board. That takes quite a lot of a county agent's time, because they have these problems. You want to hear a funny story? Maybe I shouldn't tell it. We had a tester who was mouthy. He'd always be telling the farmer something that he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that, and something. And he wasn't awfully popular when he went into these milking parlors, and they'd be in there trying to milk these cows, and he'd be telling them they weren't doing it right or something. And one day he took the milking machine off one of the cows, swung it around and broke the little nub off one of those glass jars, $140 glass jar, the little nub. And it cost $100 to get it welded back on. And the farmer wasn't very happy. And so he showed up one morning in the milking parlor there. He used to do morning milking and come back at night. At least some of them did it the other way. And he went in that morning, and he started shooting his mouth off at a fellow, at the farmer. The farmer grabbed him by the collar and threw him out of the milking parlor. And I marched him right out of there. Told him to get off the farm. Well, everything was going fine in Bennington that morning in the office, and I get the telephone call. I am never going back to that farm again. Never will I go back to that farm. Pretty soon I get a call from the farmer. He says he's got my sheets from Ithaca, my DHI sheets, from, and he took them with him. He says he's going to tear them up. I said, oh, I can't tear them up. It's hard to get another set. So we straightened it out. And I got hold of the local director, Charlie Palmer, down at Pottle, and we decided to meet at 10 o'clock in Pollet at a diner up there when Charlie Shin was running the diner. We got up there, and Charlie and I got this all planned out. He says, Morris, and you get on that side of him, and I'll get on the other side. And it was so they can't get at each other, because they were mad at each other. And so we came in, and we started, and it was, to Charlie and I, it was so funny, because both of them were very much in character. Dave was hot-headed. Morris was mouthy. And so finally we said, well, first of all, Morris, you got to get those records back. They belong to him. They don't belong to you. Okay. We got that settled down, and pretty soon we started. And then we said, now, look, we haven't got anybody else to send up to your place, and if you want to stay on DHIA, you got to give a little bit. Don't you people think you can get along? And Dave said, Dave said, well, if he'll shut his mouth, I will. And Morris said, well, I'll shut my mouth. And so he went back and did it, and then we had more trouble with him. But you had these explosions once in a while. You had to go out and settle little problems between farmers. And that was one of them. So you aren't supposed to spend much of your time with DHIA. That was Bill Lamy's job at UVM, to work with that group. And it was a farm cooperative and so on. But they, when things went wrong, who do you think they landed on? They landed on me to straighten them all out. And we used to do that. That's just one of the examples of little problems you run into.
That was back in the days when we made farm in-home visits.
Mm-hmm.
Where you went to the farmer and,
yeah.
And I went to leaders' homes, 4-H members' homes, and looked at their sheep, looked at their embroidery, whatever project they were doing, some more of an interaction between the 4-H or the agricultural agent, where you actually knew these people and you visited their homes and their farms and you had a hands-on with them.
One of the things they never seem to learn at the head office in Burlington was that you don't get anywhere with a farm family or any family or any part of extension unless they know you and you know them. And it's very hard to know them without being out on the farms with them sometimes. They forgot completely about that. Farm visits is no longer a part of what they think up there. They think that they wait for a telephone call and some guy's got a problem and they go down and help him solve the problem and leave. Well, they've never seen the guy before and won't ever see him again. And I don't think you change too much unless they know you and trust you. And you have to get that first. Some farmers, you never get to where they trust you. They just aren't that way. But a lot of them, you can. I've had farmers, I've had to tell them, you know, I don't think you're ever going to make it farming. I was with Dwight Eddy one day, and he had this fellow that didn't like farming. He didn't really like it. He had a lot of examples of why he didn't like it. wouldn't pick up anything, and he'd knock the cows around and stuff like this. And I said, "Well, don't you find something else to do, because you just aren't ever going to make it." Dwight says, "How'd you dare to say that?" I said, "I know the fellow." And he quit farming. He's been happy, and he got held down good jobs, everything since. Still got the farm, too. And kept the farm, never sold an acre of land. But this is the way it is. You really have to know people. And it takes a while to do that. And as I look around the state, I think of the old county Indians, like Roger Wickham and Ralph McWilliams and Cy Jewett. And Ray Pestle, very much so with Ray. Ray knew all those farmers. He knew their wives. He knew where the kitchen was. He knew how to go get something out of the refrigerator. this was a different world than they think of extension being today. But I think we got a lot of things done. And sometimes they're hard to put on paper. And, of course, everything in Washington is paper today. But there was most any house here, most any farm in the county, I could go on to and walk in the house and talk to the lady of the house and the family there. And because they'd seen me there before. And Betty knows this with her 4-H kids. If you have a 4-H club, you've also been in the kids' houses. I mean, you have to have this relationship.
You understood them better because you could see their home environment.
Yeah. And you can't expect the same from everybody. Some of them have a lot more ability than others. So you have to be awful careful. You don't push too hard with some people. But this business of sitting in your office all day long and waiting for telephone calls to come in doesn't work out very well as far as accomplishing things. Works out very well on reports, I guess, if you do it that way.
What did you enjoy most about your job?
I the wonderful people. They were just unbelievable. The farm people are just unbelievable, and some of the situations they get into are just unbelievable. The way they react to their farming and their areas. We had a farmer who had a terrible time with his wife. She'd buy a jug of wine, drink off the top quart, put a quart of vodka in, and finish it off, and do that every week. Well, she drove one of the boys out of the house with a loaded gun one day, and they figured they got to do something about this now. She said, surrounded. And the poor girl, she just had a problem. And so they just had to get some help for her. And when they got some help and got her straightened out, things were all right. But, I mean, I don't know anything about handling people like that, but I knew she needed help, and they did too. And so these things happen right inside the families.
So it sounds like families look to you for help with more than just their dairy operation. You were
Well,
a member of their family.
We were on this, on the dairy thing, and we'd send them to somebody who knew what they were doing when it comes to things like that.
But you were a trusted source of information and advisor.
If you're not trusted at a farm, you aren't going to get anywhere. What you tell them anyway, so you might as well forget that. I mean, they aren't going to pay any attention to you. Some of the farmers who didn't like me very well once in a while I pop off at somebody. I told a guy, I told you that 2 years ago. He got himself in a mess on a building he made, and he got himself where he couldn't get out of it without doing it over. And I said, "I told you that 2 years ago. You never say that to anybody. I ought to know better than that." But he got mad at me, but I tell you, we got along all right afterwards. But that's what you don't do. You have to learn. You don't. Some things you have to keep your mouth shut. And if I'd gone at it another way and say, "Well, we got to undo some things here you've done," and gone at it that way, but you'll not ever say to you messed it up, because they don't mess things up. Yeah, this is a difference in.
Now I heard a story about you when you were in college that you were told a friend you were walking across the green. I don't know if this is true. And stop me if I'm wrong, you were walking across the green looking at clover.
Oh, yeah. That was my roommate.
Do you want to tell me about that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of an old story. You know, and there's some people that can walk across the field and see four-leaf clovers. I can just pick up a fistful of them just walking through the field. And a lot of other people can do it. So I'd pick him up, and this fascinated Ian. He lives in Scotland now. He's my roommate for 4 years, and he lives over in Edinburgh. And he said, "What are you doing to all those clovers?" I said, "Oh, I just picked them up on the way here, out of people's lawns and stuff." I was working on a project with Ken Varney in the agronomy department. It was really nitrogen trials with corn, and I was testing their samples and stuff. And it was a seminar I was taking, and so Ian said to me, he knew I was working hard on it, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "No, I said I'm working on that red clover project, that four-leaf clover project." I made up this story. Well, he bit it. I forgot all about it. I forgot telling him this. Says, you get twice as much sunlight if you get four leaves and you have three. And I gave him this line. Well, anyway, he believed for years that I was working on this project. He was the only one that did. So that was just sort of an inside joke. Sort of. We had Ian and I. He was a political science major, turned out to be a lawyer and a law professor at Cornell. He wound up at Northwestern. He's an expert on arbitration law. Wrote books on it, law books. He's published two works on that, and he's over. I keep track of him on the phone. I call him every once in a while, and he's got cancer. And his doctor, my doctor is an expert, world expert on the kind of cancer that Ian has over there in Scotland. So he called him up and talked with him. So the world is small sometimes, you know.
So you've been out for 23 years?
Oh, yeah, I retired in 1986.
Mm. What do you miss about it, or what's hard about?
Well, some things I don't miss. I love to write, but I never liked to do the radio programs because I always wound up doing them on the weekend, Sundays and Saturdays and stuff. And this is, I guess, why. But they weren't a lot of fun. They were work. But the writing, I could sit down in the evening and write, and still can, if I want to. But I miss seeing all the people all the time. I knew all, not only knew the farmers, I knew a lot of the people in the neighborhoods where the farmers lived. And like, I go to their old home days and I meet all of them and that sort of thing. And you can't imagine what a nice bunch of people they are, really, when you get to know them. And you see their kids come up through, and you can tell which ones are going to be farmers sometimes, which ones aren't. If you ask them, they'll tell you the same thing. He'll never be able to handle the farm. Or he will. Or one of them said, one of them had a daughter, said, "I hope he marries a farm boy." Keep the farm going, you know. This sort of thing. I miss that. I miss seeing them all the time, but I keep track of a lot of them. But you know, in 23 years, there's a whole different bunch of people running these farms.
So yeah. you worked on a farm and you've been involved in this for 34 years with Extension, and you've got quite a long history. With the current dairy crisis today, have you seen anything like that during your 34 years?
They have spells where you have these swings like this. And you also have spells where they have these swings down here. For years and years in the 60s, milk sold for $4.60 a hundred. It didn't change. It just stayed, on an average, it stayed there. That was what you got, a stable price, which meant, and this was right after the bulk tanks and everything, just a lot of farmers went out of business. Only the good farmers stayed then in that business. They couldn't because And a lot of the farmers at that time were getting old. When you get to be 65 years old, you don't milk cows every day because you have to get up and down and all that. So this is a part of the what goes on is the age difference. And I used to work with farmers on partnerships with their children and stuff. Dwight Eddy and those people used to make out these things. And we'd go out and work with them and try to get partnerships set up. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. I've heard some of the county agents say, the worst thing I ever did was get these guys in a partnership. Because a partnership's very hard to get out of once you get in it, if you want to get out. It's very difficult. It's a legal mess to get out of. And we got a lot of them still operating. And they usually operate until the old-timers die and the new ones come along. And things are worked out. So, but most of the farms that are going out of business today, it's because of age of the people. I mean, they're up in their 50s now, and it's hard work, every day. And this has always been going on. There's a lot of farmers go out of business, and the children see what happens to their parents, where they're tied right down to a farm, and how hard they've worked. And a lot of them just decide they want to do something else. This is just a part of the world we live in. And now and then you get some guy that's eager beaver, and he takes the farm and goes with it. And those are the ones that are going still, doing well. But it's not an easy life, the dairy farm. And we used to work with the maple sugar people. And that was the extension forester and the people out of the ag department in Montpelier. They were all in on that. Months a year we'd have a big old meeting, and then every few years they'd have the maple rama here, and we'd work with the county forester on it, and we had some great times at those. Yeah, I can tell you some other things that have changed. if when we came here, when I came here, if we had ever gone to a DHI annual meeting, and if I'd have walked into the bar with some of my farmers and had a drink, I wouldn't have been on the job the next morning. The word would have got around. Well, pretty soon, the first thing I knew, the farmers had changed enough so that most of them are in at the bar. So then I went in and mixed in with them and had a drink with them. But see, it's how things have changed. Things are pretty pure, or supposedly so back then. That's the way people lived. I got to tell you about the lady in Reedsboro. You know her, Sprague, Elmer Sprague. She was the best cook in the Bennington County ever. I used to time my lunch to get there at the time that she'd know how to cook. I never saw that. She'd do it just on an old wood stove there in the kitchen. She'd make this wonderful pot roast and stuff. And I knew her sons and her daughters. One of her daughters went to our church here in town, Shirley. And they were complete opposites, Elmer and his wife. What was her name?
Blanche.
Yeah, Blanche was a great cook. And Blanche was an optimist like Betty. Always, everything is always up. Well, Shorty, her husband, was the opposite. The world is coming to an end tomorrow. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to stay in farming. And it was just, to see this play between the two of them was remarkable. Wonderful people. And you never saw a farm with so many stones on it in your life. They had a stone sticking up, six of them in a room this size. You know, they'd be sticking up and you'd have to mow around them. And in those days, that was how they made their living, on that little farm over there in Reedsboro. Up on the hill there.
Jim White, who was county forester for I don't know how many years, he just retired a couple of years ago, used to say, I could be blindfolded and you set me down, and I could say, I know I'm in Reedsboro.
Yeah.
There's so many rocks.
Yeah. Reedsboro is a wonderful community. You have these differences in communities, and you find that out fairly quickly. Reedsboro, the wonderful people there, they're very community minded, and they look out for each other. These little communities. See, they're not near anybody else, and so that's the way they operate there. And Stamford, they're kind of a bedroom town for North Adams. It's just the opposite. I mean, they don't seem to have anything holding them together. They're just sort of flopping around down there. And I found out that when I was running for office, Reedsboro was an easy place to work. Stanford didn't do any good to go there. I mean, it was sort of... And then one of the other nice places in the county was Rupert, West Rupert, over in the mountains. The areas that are isolated, they have a different attitude than the ones that live in a place like Dorset Village, where you got rich people and everybody living together. They're quite different. The community spirit is different.
Now, were you serving in the legislature at the same time? You were?
No. That was afterward.
What was that like for you?
Well, I was in the House 2 years, and I enjoyed the House. It was really different. When I got into the Senate, I stayed there 4 years. Well, that wasn't so much fun. There was more, a lot of politics in the Senate. I mean, more so. If you had problems to try to work on stuff, you're better off in the House. I didn't know enough to stay there. I could have, but I didn't. And I made a mistake when I switched. Somebody taught me into running. I enjoyed. I'm glad I went, but I don't want to ever go back up there. You know, leave home and be gone all week up there. And it's sort of an artificial place, the legislature is. Her father knows about it. Ira was up there, and her neighbor, Roy Lawrence, was up. He was the Speaker of the House when he was up there. They were made different. Different kind of people. Roy Lawrence loved that. That was his thing. I don't think Ira liked it awfully well, did he, up there?
He did?
Yeah. Well, he had people like Jim Edgerton and stuff with him up there.
I thoroughly enjoyed my experience.
But you're in the House, though.
Yeah.
Well, in the House, it's a lot better.
Committee work.
Yeah, a lot of committee work, and you're only on one committee. And you have the chance to so that's it's another world. The legislature is, though. A lot of stuff goes on a long way from where you are when you're up there. I mean, that's all done in the back room. A lot of stuff goes on up there.
What would you say to somebody who came up to you and said, John, I know you were a county agent for many years, and I've thought about farming, and I want to give it a go. What sort of advice would you give a young person who wants to buy a farm and get into the dairy business?
I should remember what Dan Kerrigan told us once. He says, don't ever tell anybody this is not the time to start farming. He says, we've been doing that now for 100 years. Now is as good a time as any to start farming. And this is right. But before you start farming, you better know what you're getting into. And a lot of the people that have got a bundle of money don't have any idea what they're getting into. And so I'd say that I've done this with people. I'd say, look, before you do this, why don't you go and work for a good farmer somewhere? Don't go and work for somebody with some philosophy that agrees with you. Work for a farmer that has to work for a living and find out what it's about and then see if you want to do it. Because no matter what I tell you, it isn't going to be what you think it is. And we've had some people that have done that, gone to work for someone else for a while, for a year or so, and like Carl Fuller, turned out to be a great farmer, good farmer. And we've had other people do it. I wouldn't ever try to discourage anybody from doing it. But you always want to remember what one guy said once. He says, I know there's money in farming. I left a lot of mine there. you can leave a lot of money in farming and lose it if you don't look out. I mean, it's not one of those things. You've got to be a businessman. And I don't care what your philosophy is or whether you're sustainable or not sustainable. That hasn't much to do with whether or not you stay in business. You stay in business because you, the input and your output and your work in between is balanced out here so that you have a business going. And farming is a business. And if you don't like it, well, you better stay out of it. And you don't have to be big to be a good farmer either. A lot of people think you do today, but you don't.
The emphasis now on growing organic vegetables and fruit in the market for eating locally, you know.
Some of them are going to do quite well at that. But you know, can't everybody do this? Because most of them won't get out there with a hoe and take care of things. I mean, you have to be a hard worker to be a truck farmer. And the other thing is, all your money comes in 2 months of the year, July and August, and everything's gone. And if you haven't made it by then, well, you can have a greenhouse out there and make some money and raising plants in the spring and stuff. But you see, there's many kinds of farmers. We got some people that full-time jobs that stop for sugaring. And they do very well. They tend to the sugar bush, do a good job of it. And we're gonna see a lot of that. Business, that sort of thing. We're going to see more more of this, what we call agro-tourism. We've always had a few of those. Remember the Hill Farm, when for years and years and years they had took in tourists, and they'd all go out in the barn and get in Earl's way. Howard ran the tourist business, and his brother had run the farm, and they Earl got so those guys that was in his way when he was milking, they were standing around there talking, he got used to it, you know. And they meet a lot of nice people that way. But they made some money in that tourist business of theirs. Yeah.
It was a good landmark, too.
Yeah.
You wanted to tell people where to turn, 4-H Camp Mondawa.
Turn right in front of Hill Farm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, whenever we wanted some mowing done over at the camp, go over and get Earl Hill. He'd come over and mow the fields for you. And that was a wonderful thing. They were very much helpful to the 4-H camp. The Hill family was. Yeah.
Yeah. Betty, listening to John, were there other stories or things that you wanted to add for the? Because I can get the mic back on you. How about here we do this?
Give her the mic.
I'm going to put it on the table so we can get both of you at the same time. How's that sound?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to thank you.